And then about 20 years ago, when I was working for the government doing a foresight program, looking to the future, it kind of came to a brainstorm one day that because alcohol is such a promiscuous drug, it would be impossible to find antidotes to all the harms that alcohol does. And maybe we just have to replace it.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Professor David Nutt has never shied away from controversy. In 2009, he was fired as chairman of the UK government's advisory committee on the misuse of drugs because he said that alcohol and tobacco are more harmful than many illegal drugs, including LSD and ecstasy. He also said that more people died from horse riding every year than from ecstasy, and the government was not amused. Dave, as he likes to be known, is a neuropsychopharmacologist known for his research on drugs affecting the brain. He has a huge string of academic titles and is the founder of Drug Science, a non-profit organisation that provides evidence-based information on drugs. He's also published more than 1,000 research papers and 35 books. The reason I wanted him on the podcast is that he's in the middle of developing a compound called Alkarel, which is designed to mimic the effects of alcohol without leaving behind any hangovers or health risks. Alkarel is still being developed. However, his company has already released a botanical non-alcoholic spirit called Sentia that uses herbs to target receptors in the brain that promote relaxation and sociability. Sentia is supposed to mimic some of the effects of alcohol without any of the downsides. I ordered both versions and DHL told me they were going to deliver them at about the same time that I was going to do this interview. So you'll hear us refer to the impending doorbell during the podcast. The bottles actually arrived after the interview and I tried them that night. Both are quite vermouth-like in character, and what I particularly liked was that they had bitterness and complexity without sugar, which is the downside of so many non-alcoholic spirit substitutes. Sentia Red, the more spicy one, was definitely my favour, though I would recommend Sentia Black to the coffee lovers, as it had those kinds of notes. Now, I have to say, I didn't feel particularly affected by either drink, and nor did I get any of the effects that are usual with alcohol. But to be clear, I was by myself when I tried them, and of course, I can't really judge my own reactions and behaviours. If somebody had been present, they might have seen something different. Anyway, I recommend them to anyone who likes slightly bitter drinks. In fact, have a glass while you listen to this episode where the conversation rages from the state of hangover research to whether it will be possible one day to have a drink that gives us every aspect of alcohol without any of the harms. And as always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter. To sign up, just go to drinksinsider.com. Dave, what got you interested in alcohol research?
Well, as a doctor, I see the problems of alcohol every day. In fact, my very first day at medical school, I saw strange and very disturbing behaviour from medical students who were very drunk.
And really?
Absolutely. I saw one of them becoming so tearful and upset, I thought he was going to commit suicide. But wow. One of his friends said, no, he's always like that when he's drunk, which I thought was quite odd, considering he was only 18 and he shouldn't have been drinking really at all. So at that point, I obviously monitored my own drinking, which has been excessive at times, and I've watched so many other people drunk, and then I've gone into medicine and dealt with people who are in withdrawal, people who are craving, people who are having hallucinations and DTs. And actually, the first 20-odd years of my life, I worked towards reducing the harms of alcohol in terms of antidotes, in terms of anti-craving agents, in terms of new treatments of withdrawal. And then about 20 years ago, when I was working for the government doing a foresight program, looking to the future, it kind of came to a brainstorm one day that because alcohol is such a promiscuous drug, it would be impossible to find antidotes to all the harms that alcohol does. And maybe we just have to replace it.
That is the heart of what I'm going to ask you about. But I want to go back a couple of steps. So you worked out a molecule to sober up a rat. What happened to that?
Yeah, well, that's part of my story. I was doing my PhD in Oxford, and I was working on the GABA system. That was essentially I worked out ways of studying GABA in living organisms, rats and humans. And I asked the question one afternoon, you know, does alcohol work with the GABA system? We kind of suspected it might.
Okay, I'm just going to stop you. Can you explain what the GABA system is?
Yeah, so the GABA system is the main calming system in the brain. GABA is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical which is made in the brain. A very large proportion of the neurons in the brain are sensitive to GABA. About 10% of all the neurons in your brain make GABA. So GABA is what keeps you calm. And an alcohol, we believe, mediates its primary relaxing sociability effects through enhancing GABA. So that was a theory that was just about beginning to rear its head when I started my PhD. Up till that point, people had thought that alcohol was a solvent and that the effects of intoxication with alcohol were all due to the fact that it would get into cell neuronal membranes and disrupt them in the same way, for instance, as other solvents, if people inhale solvents or gases. But we became clear that alcohol was working on receptors. And one of the receptors we thought was a GABA receptor. So I tested that theory. I got a rat intoxicated, I blocked the GABA receptor, and it sobered up. And I really thought, wow, this is the Nobel Prize. I went rushing into my professor, my mentor, and said, I've got an alcohol antidote. This is, you know, shall I book a ticket to Oslo? And he said, what's the point of that? And I said, well, you could sober up and drive home. You know, you might kind of remember who you were in bed with the next morning. You know, all sorts of strange things happen when people get drunk. And he said, yeah, but surely it'll still rot their liver and their hearts and their stomach. In fact, wouldn't they drink more if they were so, you know, and deflation took over and Nobel Prize hasn't emerged. But it was the first proof that GABA was central to the effects of alcohol.
There is still time for the Nobel Prize, maybe not for that. Okay, so I'm going to jump all over the place before we get to the central topic, which is the drink. But so you are clearly well up on the many harms of alcohol. I mean, you've written a book about alcohol. So, but you also own a wine bar. Can you talk about how you came to do that?
Well, I've always had an ambivalent relationship to alcohol. I mean, as a doctor, as I've already mentioned, I've seen over the decades many, many different harms from alcohol. But I've used alcohol, like most people, successfully to relax, to become sociable, to engage with others. I mean, alcohol is the ultimate pro-social drug. That's why we still have it. If it wasn't doing some good to us, we would have just not bothered to drink. I mean, the fact that 80% of the population drink something sometimes tells us that it's actually an active, positive decision, because these people aren't dependent. They're not forced to drink. And with my daughter was very interested in setting up a wine bar that served the optimal purpose of alcohol, which is to bring people together in small social groups in a convivial environment, free from soccer and TV screens of sports, serving nice food. So people could actually go and really get the benefits that most people, particularly women, want from alcohol. So it turned out to be a bar that was very popular with women who'd come in small groups and have a social evening drinking some nice wine, organic wine, relatively expensive wine, so to discourage too much drinking, in an environment where they weren't going to get pestered by drunk men.
So what wines do you serve?
Well, we serve, yeah, a whole range of wines. I mean, from all sorts of places, you know, ranging, I think, from Georgia through to Portugal.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's my daughter is called Susie. She's sort of hunted down organic wine manufacturers from all around Europe, and I think we have a few from overseas as well, or beyond Europe.
Okay, so you were famously sacked for telling the truth about alcohol and its many harms. And one of those harms was the hangover. Can you explain how damaging hangovers are, not just for the person, but for society in general?
Yes, hangovers must be the largest unresearched cause of ill health in the world.
Unresearched, that's interesting. It's so ubiquitous. Well,
yes. Yes, because it's so common and because it's self-inflicted. There's almost no, I mean, we knew 100 years ago, just over 100 years ago, when the First World War started, it was very apparent that the British war effort was being undermined. And I use that as a pun, because miners weren't going to work on Mondays, because so many miners were hungover on a Monday. The absenteeism was massive. And that was what brought in the licensing laws. Up to that point, bars, pubs didn't have any constraints on when they served. So the licensing laws were brought in to reduce drunkenness and to improve the productivity of the population in the war effort. And we now know that the cost of a hangover in Britain is somewhere between about 10 and 20 billion pounds a year. It's more costly to society in terms of lost productivity than the cost of policing drunkenness and the health costs of alcohol put together. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. What is it? Okay, so what is happening in the brain that makes that gives you, when you have a hangover, it's not just the headache and the dehydration, it's also that feeling of paranoia and regret and all of the emotional things that come along with the hangover. What causes that?
Well, it's a combination of things. As alcohol is a promiscuous drug, it affects multiple neurotransmitters in the brain, and they adapt. And so what hangover is in part due to compensatory changes in the brain to offset the effects of alcohol. But the bigger problem with alcohol, it's also a toxin. It produces free radicals, and its metabolite acetaldehyde also produces more free radicals. Free radicals cause inflammation. Inflammation activates immune cells. So a hangover is like a short bout of flu, basically, largely focused on the brain.
Right, it's such a universal and such a horrible experience, and yet and people go back again and do it again.
Well, strangely, and this is one of the things that got me fascinated by the brain mechanisms of alcohol, because in the 1980s, I spent 2 years running the research ward at the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C. on alcohol, and I interviewed every patient we brought in, and we were largely studying consequences of heavy drinking and the brain mechanisms which underpinned alcohol addiction. So I interviewed every patient that came through the ward over 2 years. And of course, one of the questions I would always ask them is, do you have hangovers? And almost all of them said no.
Really?
And that was quite illuminating, because it suggested to me that the hangovers actually do have some kind of preventative effect. Really bad hangovers are a deterrent. I mean, most people carry on drinking despite having them, but not having hangovers at all really does make you vulnerable to becoming dependent.
So is that a physiological quirk of those people that they don't get hangovers, or is it that they're so habituated to alcohol that they no longer get hangovers?
Well, as I said, it's the least researched illness in medicine, and the answer is we do not know.
God, that's amazing.
And it's disturbing, isn't it?
There are people out there, yeah.
Disturbing, we don't know.
That is really disturbing. So why is it under-researched? Is it because just nobody has decided to do it, or is there a problem around researching alcohol? What's the barrier?
Yes, well, it's there's no incentive by the industry to research it. Governments tend to take the view that it's your own fault for getting a hangover. Governments like the drinks industry. Falsely, most governments are under the false impression that the drinks industry is a net provider of income. The drinks industry certainly is a net provider of tax, but that tax benefit is offset significantly by the harms, and particularly by the loss of productivity from hangover. So actually governments are wrong in not trying to control drinking and are letting it basically, we still in Britain, we still advertise alcohol. It's kind of surreal, really. But getting back to the fundamental question, who's interested in studying hangover? Who's interested in studying the harms of alcohol? Very few people.
Perhaps. Well, of course, there was an attempt to study alcohol through the National Institute of Health in America, but that was, the researchers were shut down because the alcohol industry funded it.
Yes. So one of the reasons I quite like working in this space is that you're at a juxtaposition between science and moral positions. There's a very fascinating sort of antipathy to alcohol by many people. And so that's why actually the question you raised a little while ago, but you run a bar. To some people that they would see that as being completely unethical for someone who's trying to reduce the harms of alcohol to actually be involved in selling alcohol. I do take this unusual position, which is I'm both for it and against it. I'm for the good things and against the bad things. And of course, that's underpinned the direction of travel, which we'll come to in a minute, which is trying to replace alcohol. But I would like to share with you, Felicity, a terrifying statistic. Not only, after hangover, the next least studied major problem in medicine is alcoholic cirrhosis.
Is that right?
Over 80%. So we have every major university, every major hospital in the world has a hepatology department, a liver department. 80% of the people or more going through the liver department have got alcohol-related liver disease, either hepatitis or cirrhosis. When you look at the research spend on liver disease, 95% of it is on other liver disease. And 5% is on alcoholic liver disease. And again, that must reflect a moral position that people who drink deserve it, and we shouldn't be studying ways of reducing the harm, which of course is outrageous and stupid.
It's interesting. A friend of mine was a spinal researcher, and he could never get money. And he said it was because people who donate money to research donate to things that they think will affect them. So heart disease gets loads and loads absolutely. Of funding because broken spines happen to young men in fast cars. There's no incentive
who are often
for
drunk.
To fund it. Yeah, so maybe something like that is happening with the research. What do you think about this? I've also heard that doctors don't talk to patients enough about alcohol because they also like their wine.
Yeah, well, medical students drink more than the average student, possibly because they're slightly better off because they come from more middle-class backgrounds, but they should know better, let's put it that way. And there's this wonderful, famous, very famous joke which goes around in the UK. I'm not sure if it's true in the US, but what's the definition of an alcoholic? Answer, someone who drinks more than their doctor. And that is absolutely true. Doctors don't consider heavy drinking to be a problem because that's what they do themselves.
It's funny, when I was at university, I remember walking past a pile of bodies of medical students all sort of close to being passed out and thinking, in 10 years they're going to be saying to people, don't drink, don't smoke. And, okay, so going back to this, let's talk about Alcarel, if I've pronounced it correctly.
You have
actually produced a molecule that gives some of the feelings of intoxication without actually being intoxicating. Can you talk about how you developed it?
So when I came up with this idea that maybe we've got to replace alcohol, it was based on a growing knowledge that alcohol had pharmacology. It wasn't just a lipid-dissolving solvent. So what was the pharmacology we knew about? And over at that time and subsequently, we discovered that at least 8 neurotransmitters in the brain are targeted by alcohol. And we can begin to portion out the
how many neurotransmitters are there in total in the brain, like what a percentage is alcohol targeting?
Well, that's a slightly complicated question to answer, because there's 80 neurotransmitters in the brain, of which about 40 we understand something of, but 90% of the neurons in the brain work on a neurotransmitter called glutamate, which alcohol blocks. about 8% of the neurons in the brain produce a neurotransmitter called GABA, which alcohol potentiates. So that leaves about 2% of all the other neurons. So yeah, there are lots of neurotransmitters, but the real biggies are the target of alcohol.
Right. So go back to developing Alkaril.
So the challenge was work out how alcohol gives you the beneficial effects and how it causes harms. And the reality is that the first drink of alcohol, which is the drink that begins to relax and chill people out and let them engage in social activity, is through enhancing GABA. And then if you take another drink, you begin to start to enhance dopamine, which makes you loud and noisy. And then a bit more releases endorphins, which begins to get you addicted and disinhibited. And then if you get to about four drinks, you begin to block glutamate. And glutamate is the on switch of the brain. And that's where you begin to get people forgetting and falling over and going into sort of intoxicated sleep, etc. So it's very simple. All you've got to do is target the GABA system to a point where you mimic alcohol without getting sedation, and don't target all the other neurotransmitters. Now, okay, that's easy to say. It's not so easy to do, but nature has given us both a challenge and an opportunity with GABA, because GABA is so important, and every neuron in the brain is sensitive to GABA, that the brain over evolution has produced 15 different subtypes of the GABA receptor. So what we did then was to hunt down the ones which occur in the parts of the brain which produce relaxation, sociability, conviviality, etc. And then enhance GABA at those receptor subtypes, thereby avoiding the impact of GABA in other parts of the brain, which where it causes you perhaps to become unsteady or to fall asleep, you know, or to get dependence or to get a hangover.
You're talking about tiny, tiny structures in the brain. How did you find those receptors?
Those receptors were found, initially those receptors were inferred from the activity of putting GABA on them, because if you put GABA on a neuron with those receptors, the neuron calms down. And that's why it's the relaxing.
How do you put GABA on a neuron?
Well, you have a neuron in a dish with some artificial cerebral spinal fluid and it's firing away, beep, beep, beep. And then you squirt some GABA on and it goes, and then you take the GABA off, it goes beep, beep, beep. Or you can do what I did, put the GABA on and it goes silent, and then put a GABA antagonist on and it goes beep, 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 beep.
Okay, so there's a big difference between turning things on in a Petri dish and the government allowing you to do something that will do this in the brain.
Yes.
So in the period between the Petri dish and the drink, how did you get regulatory approval for this? Well, I mean, how long did it take?
Well, let me be very clear. Alkaril is a concept. We have molecules which do what we want to do, but it's not yet on the market. We're in the process of raising money to take that molecule through what's called food safety testing in America, called GRAS, generally regarded as safe. That process is underway. But in the interim, and what you're receiving when your front bell rings in a minute, are drinks called Sentia. You're getting some Sentia Red and some Sentia Black. And these are botanical drinks, which we've created and are still creating, which have been available for about 3 years now. And these contain a range of different herbs which themselves make molecules which enhance GABA in the brain. So the difference between Sentia, a drink, and Alkaril will be an ingredient that we will license to drinks companies so they can make any drink they like that currently has alcohol in it, but take the alcohol out and put the Alkaril in.
Okay, so I'll stick on the Alkaril for a second. So where is it? So what am I asking you? So the molecule exists. Where is it up to in the testing at the moment?
Well, we've made a series of molecules. The way you do this kind of chemistry is obviously you have a plan. You try to learn from the literature of what GABA receptors are and what molecules, it's like GABA itself interacts with GABA. And then you start divining molecules and then you test them. And then you've got to refine and refine because you've got to get the selectivity to the receptor subtypes. But there's also another twist to this, which is slightly technical. But what you want is a ceiling effect. What the problem with alcohol is there are no ceiling effects. I mean, if you keep on drinking, eventually you get more and more intoxicated and you die. We want a ceiling. We want a ceiling. And the ceiling will be the effect of two drinks of alcohol. So you're relaxed, but it doesn't matter if you drank a whole bottle. It wouldn't harm you. It wouldn't kill you. So that's what, you know, so that getting that, that's a technical term we call partial agonism in pharmacology. So we've got to get the right targets, the right efficacy, not too powerful. And then we've got to get what's called the kinetics. We've got to get the molecules to get in the brain quickly like alcohol and get out quickly like alcohol. And that's really quite a complicated series of asks to make of chemistry. But we're there. We've got three or four molecules. We're in the process of making that decision. Which one will we scale up to take into safety testing? And that is a huge decision because the cost of going into US FDA safety testing is of the order of, you know, several million dollars.
And given that it has some of the effects of intoxication, will you be able to drive or operate machinery when you've had it? Like, how?
You shouldn't do anything that involves optimal concentration if you're affected by anything. So whether it's Alcarel or whether it's Centia or whether it's alcohol or whether it's having a cold. I mean, a heavy head cold will impede your driving performance as much as it depends on the country, but certainly not in the UK and US, the threshold's about 80 milligrams percent of alcohol can be mimicked by having a cold or flu. So anything that impairs your mental functioning should indicate to you shouldn't be driving. So we're not recommending people drive on Alcarel or Centia, no. Wait till the effects worn off.
So let's talk about Centia. When did you start developing it?
About 5 years ago, when we began to invent and explore the small molecules for Alcarel. But we realised when we went to estimate the costs of making those and taking them through testing, it was going to be a big challenge to get investment. You know, I mean, well, I thought at first it'd be easy. I thought people would say, wow, this is genius. You know, how much money can we give you, David? But it didn't work out like that for some strange reason. Even very rich people seem to be quite cautious. Because it's for billionaires, it's a trivial amount of money. But anyway, we couldn't get that initial funding to take the synthetic through. So what we thought, well, hang on, why don't we make a proof of concept? And so we made Centia. And Centia is a GABA acting drink. We call it a functional spirit because it's a non-alcoholic drink that mimics some of the effects of alcohol. So it's not a non-alcoholic drink, which does nothing other than taste like lemonade. And it's not an alcoholic drink, which has alcohol. It's a third way. We call it a functional drink or a GABA spirit.
Okay, I'll just go back a couple of steps and have two questions. First of all, who is the we that you're talking about? And how did you, when you decided to create a functional drink, which is a growing market, where did you start? Did you start looking through the herbal literature? What was your jumping off point?
So the we is me and my partner in the company called David Oren. He's the chief executive. And to be honest, it was his vision. His idea was to try to make a drink which would be a proof of concept. And I said, David, I don't know anything about plants. And he said, well, you know, go and learn. So to answer your second question, we employed a very smart postdoc who was in between jobs called Meg Spriggs. And he said, Meg, you know, go out there and find us all the plants you can find that got stuff in that work on the GABA system. And she hunted the literature. There are millions of molecules found in plants, and a number of them have been tested for activity, and quite a few work on the GABA system. And it's fascinating because these are plants that people kind of knew of before. Plants that help relax you, like chamomile or ashwagandha. Turns out that they contain molecules which work on the GABA system. So Meg and then one of my team called Robin Tynack, they spent a couple of years putting together herbal mixtures until eventually they found the right cocktail, which we now have improved and as Scentia.
So the right cocktail in terms of taste or in terms of efficacy?
In terms of efficacy. So everything is about efficacy. The taste of Scentia is something which was added by a lady called Vanessa Jacoby, who joined the company afterwards, because she's an expert. She comes from the tea-making field, so she's an expert at taste. So she made them very palatable, if you like that. They're quite strong, quite exotic taste, so rather like vermouths. But the efficacy is the critical thing, because, of course, you can submerge taste in anything. When most people still drink Scentia with mixers like tonic or Coke or ginger beer.
So going back to the efficacy, how, I mean, you know, there's lots of herbs out there. There's lots of possible combinations. What was the process for testing?
Well, the first thing was to look at the literature on which herbs have been used for relaxation. And we looked at Chinese data. We looked at Ayurvedic medicine. We looked at historic European data. There's quite a lot of herbs out there that people have used for this purpose. And the advantage of using food herbs, by the way, is really critical, because if they've been in the food chain before 1997, then they're exempt from any kind of food testing. They're considered as safe. And so that's why we can sell it as a food or a food supplement, depending on where we're selling it. So find things which we know are approved. And then there are actually three separate elements in Scentia. There are herbs which do actually enhance GABA in the brain. There are herbs which accelerate the uptake from the stomach of those substances from those herbs. And there are substances that also facilitate the transfer of those active substances from the blood into the brain. So it's a sort of three-step process: get it into the body, get it into the brain, and then turn on the GABA system. And then the fourth element, of course, is the taste and the colouring.
I'm just interested that you're saying that you went through Ayurvedic and Chinese literature, because that's really, we're getting into the realm of alternative medicine. Without wanting to offend anybody, how reliable is the literature on what's in those herbs?
Oh, no. So it's remarkable how smart the historic users of herbs have become. And we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, we're looking at medicines which have been developed from herbs over several thousand, maybe 4,000 years. It's quite likely they got it right. But what they didn't know, of course, is what the molecular structure of the active ingredients were. They just knew that the herbs were active. And it turns out, you know, modern botanists can take a herb and they can examine millions of different, well, not millions, but thousands of different molecules in the herb. And it turns out that some of them actually are molecules which we have discovered for other research work on the GABA system. So we've kind of validated the historic traditional way of developing relaxants, I suppose.
So now you've got your drink, and now is the challenge of taking it to market. Can you talk about how did you do it? Did you do market research? Did you do sampling programs? Did you test it on people? Did you test it on people at your wine bar?
The wine bar was the first place we started using it. We have done tests. We've done tests to compare it with alcohol. We've done tests to compare it with other drinks. Just to essentially be able to say it works. I mean, it didn't work. I mean, we worked on us, but obviously it needs to work on normal human beings, not people that want a kind of...
So what does it do to you?
Well, it relaxes you. People, you notice it's kind of uncannily similar to alcohol in a way. You notice after maybe 4 or 5 minutes, apart from the taste. I mean, some people get very activated and very entranced by the taste, but if you're using it as a mixer and you're drinking, say, it with tonic, then after a few minutes, you begin to feel that slight sort of that feeling that alcohol has, that slight relaxation over the jowl. And then you begin to feel a bit, you know, you might not feel relaxed, but people notice you're more relaxed. You smile more. I get loud. You can tell when I'm drinking it because, you know, my voice goes up, my enthusiasm goes up. I start to become more engaged with people. I'm looking at more, you know, more in the eye, etc. So it's really rather similar to that first alcohol drink.
That's interesting. You know, the getting the loud thing, that's the thing that when I have a hangover, I'm lying there regretting. So I'll be interested to see what Centia does to me. But
well, I hope you don't have a hangover because no one else has got one.
So no, that's right. But there is some evidence, isn't there, that the way you behave when you're drunk is socially mediated, that you do behave a bit according to what the social expectations of drunkenness are. Is that true or not true?
Oh, it's both are true. And a lot depends on how experienced a drinker you are and how much you've drunk. So, yes, so kids starting to drink, you know, will often sort of pretend, you know, they will pretend they're drunk even if they're drinking something that doesn't have alcohol in because they want to pretend that they are. For heavy drinkers, the opposite's true. For people who are heavy drinkers, before they drink or as soon as they start to drink, the brain starts to adapt and to compensate for what it knows is going to be an intoxicating effect, which it doesn't like. And if they don't drink, then they go into a kind of early withdrawal, a conditioned withdrawal, we call it, and they can have that can cause significant levels of anxiety. Expectation is complicated. It depends the same very much on the brain state and the prior exposure to alcohol.
It's so interesting. All right, let's go back to Centia. So you've got your drink and you've been testing it on your wine bar. You've been testing it on yourself.
Yes.
How did you get it to market?
Yes. Well, so we started manufacturing it as, you know, bottles of the stuff.
And where did you start?
Oh, yes. Okay. So we set up a laboratory. We have a little laboratory in a place called Hemel Hempstead, just north of London. And we started manufacturing. And so the process of making Centia is a process of, it's not distillation. It's a process of steeping. It's taking herbs and extracting the best bits of them in water at different temperatures. Some need higher temperatures than others. So we make extracts and then we bring the extracts together and we actually build the drink in a brewery, because that's the only place we could find that has big enough pots to actually make hundreds of litres of stuff. And then so we put it together, hold it together so that you know for a few hours so that you maximise the extracts and then decant it into bottles. And then how do we sell it? Well, we started selling it by telling people about it. We did have some advertisements. We did a bit of online stuff. And I did quite a lot of podcasts, talking to people like you. And some of them had quite a big effect on people wanting to buy. So I hope yours does too.
And dare I ask, how many bottles have you sold so far?
Wow, bottles. Well, it must... I don't... Let me... So let me. I suppose I can work it out by sales. So we've doubled our sales year on year. We've been going for 3 years now, and last year we sold over £1 million worth.
Wow! So I thought you were going to tell me like we've sold 300 bottles. That's amazing.
Well, yes. Yeah, so that's so, about what's that? That's about how many bottles is that? £1 million is say at £30 a bottle. What's that? So that's about 30,000 bottles. Yeah.
Good grief, because I found out about it because a friend of mine forwarded an email, and so I immediately sent off. It hasn't arrived yet. It's going to arrive any moment. All right, so if I may, can I ask, it's very expensive bringing things like this to market. I imagine the herbs must be very expensive. So where did the funding come from?
Well, most of us work for free.
Right.
Which is true, you know, we're a startup, we are enthusiasts, we do it for free. I've invested quite a bit of my own money in the company as well. So it's come from us, is the answer.
Well, you've got such an incredibly impressive team. I was looking on the website. I mean, you've got specialists from so many different specialties. Are they all just volunteering because they're fascinated?
Very few of them are paid, yeah. I mean, obviously there's a lure of some share options in the future if we go public. But yes, a lot of them are genuinely In fact, we wouldn't work with people that weren't committed to the cause. And the cause is to have a rational approach to alcohol. So where people can get the benefits of alcohol, which, as I say, most people want, with really reduced harms.
Well, actually, let's just talk about the benefits of alcohol, because I've reported on wine for more than 20 years, and there's a lot of people who care about a lot more than intoxication. They care about the complexity. They care about, you know, I can't stop people talking about soil types and how it affects grapes,
absolutely,
and so on. So, you know, it's the craft aspect of it that so many geeky types find so attractive. Do you think one of these drinks could ever approach the complexity and the nuance of a fine wine or a whiskey?
Undoubtedly. I think when you get your Centias today, or whenever you get them, try them.
Just waiting for that doorbell.
Try them neat. Try them neat with a bit of ice, because as I say, they are like vermouths, which is, you know, an established part of essentially the wine trade, isn't it? I mean, they're just concentrated wines. And they do have complex aromas. They do have complex tastes. They have very interesting mouthfeel. So I think they will never, the herbals will never be the same as wine. But for people who are interested in that, you know, an alternative, they will definitely appeal to them. And for a lot of people, it's about having something that they can drink and enjoy in the week without the risk of having any kind of mild hangover. Because even a couple of glasses of wine will change your sleep and, to some extent, impair your performance.
I've done Dry January the last couple of years, and I've discovered it's not the alcohol that I really missed. It was the ritual of just, you know, something. And you do need, and so many of the substitutes are so awful, particularly the de-alcoholized wines. So one of the things that people have told me is that when they offer non-alc alternatives, that it increases their overall sales, because people might have one alcoholic drink and then they might have a sophisticated non-alcoholic drink. Have you noticed anything like that in your wine bar? Has Centia changed the behaviour of people?
Well, there are pulses of change when these kind of podcasts and articles go out, yes. There are bars now. I mean, there are a number of alcohol-free pubs in Britain, and you know, cocktails made from Centia, you know, popular. So yeah, I mean, it hasn't dramatically changed the profile in the wine bar, but it's available. We make up special cocktails at particular times, and people seem to like that.
So just talking about intoxication, you're also an expert on psychedelics. And one of the things that's happening in the US market is there's more and more of these functional drinks that are promising all kinds of pharmacological benefits. Do you think that humans like intoxication and will simply replace one intoxicant with another, whether it's cannabis or whether it's ashwagandha or psilocybin? Or where do you see the future of all of this going?
Well, I think people are becoming much more sophisticated. I think calling them intoxicants is rather demeaning their value. I mean, alcohol is a relaxant. It is the ultimate social drug. As I say, that's why psychedelics have a very different role. I mean, they're not social drugs. I mean, they're definitely interesting ways of changing the way you think about things and interesting ways of perhaps healing you from disorders like anxiety and depression or addiction. But they have very different roles. Cannabis, yeah, a lot of people prefer cannabis to alcohol because it's kind of more calming, perhaps, and less, you know, you don't get hangovers from cannabis. So I think what we're seeing is, you know, I think what we should, it's not just seeing, what we should have are a range of legal alternatives so people can make their mind up in a rational way and be sure that what they're getting is actually what it says on the bottle and or the tin or whatever, and is relatively, you know, free of any...
So finally, going back to Alcarel, what sort of time period do you envisage before that may be commercially available, and what hoops do you have to jump through for it to come to market?
So we've decided we're going to take it through the American system, the GRAS system, generally regarded as safe. Why we're doing that? Because America's the only country in the world that actually does explicitly say if you do this and it is safe, you will get approval. That process will take probably 2 years. So as soon as the check is signed, we will start.
That's wonderful. And on that note, I'll say thank you very much for giving me your time. That was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, Felicity. Good to talk.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.